Hey Douglas, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi Doug.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing good. Hey, that 10 o'clock, is that my time tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, because it usually says in my time zone, and that's the only reason I clarify, because I want to be sure
Okay.
I want to show up. So, you know.
Yeah, we've had problems with that in the past, so yeah, I might go
Yeah.
back to saying this time and in your time zone. But
Yeah.
it will be 1 hour
Yeah.
later than typical.
No, that'll work out fine. I just hope it's comfortable for you because it sounds like you got a lot going on.
Just a lot of traveling. We're doing all sorts of random trainings, which I'm
Yeah.
not particularly interested in. There's one on active shooting, like how
Oh.
to respond to that. It was interesting, but not
Yeah.
something I've been 3 hours on. And tomorrow will be suicide prevention. So yeah, we've talked about that, so I'll have some insight into that if we have a
Yeah,
discussion.
I have personal insight on that. You know, per my experience.
Right.
So, anyway, yeah, I like a lot of things that's coming down the chute. You know, and that. Have you ever heard of a book called Waking, Dreaming, and Being by Evan Thompson?
No, I haven't.
Well, he's one of the inactive embodied teachers that's been around for about 30 years. And in that book, he talks about I like he changed the frame from disembodied experience to altered embodiment. That he's trying to show that that we just have a different experience of our body when we say we have an outer body experience.
You said Jonathan Thompson?
Evan Thompson, Waking,
Evan.
Dreaming, and Being. It's an interesting take on those experiences. Yeah, John?
Yeah, hi everybody. Yeah, I read Evan's book.
Yeah.
Didn't think much of it, to tell you the truth. I thought it was a deeply, there's a lot of great information in it, but it was extremely materialistic, reductive. Unlike his father, you know, his father is William Irwin Thompson, who
Right.
started Bendis Farm.
And they hung out with Gregory Thompson, Bateson and a lot of other people from back in that day.
And William Irwin Thompson mentions his son, Evan Thompson, as one of the materialists. And he is not, and William Irwin Thompson comes from a very different place, you know. So I wonder what their conversations are like around the dinner table.
Yeah, right.
One's a reductive materialist, and another one is a very much an integral thinker, immersed in Aurobindo and Piaget and Gebser. He's a great Gebser scholar. Hey, Mark. Hi, Doug.
So
Let's get it on.
Is Marco coming today? Do we know?
Marco.
He's there.
Oh,
One of
Marco,
the
are you
Marcos
here,
are here.
Marco? I know Ed said he wasn't going to make it today. Okay. Shall we start? Okay. Oh, and can I ask, is it possible that when we're recording this, we could do it with, you know, when I see it uploaded and it's a composite with everybody's face on all at once and they're little tiny squares, I don't like that for the purpose of doing a presentation, especially if other people are going to be showing. You know, I want to give a chance for everyone to show a drawing or a representation. It's just this little bitty square with a talking head and you can't see the drawing. So is there any way, Marco, that we could have, when this is uploaded, a full screen so that we can see a whole face?
Yeah, actually, the Zoom produces two recordings. It produces a recording of the gallery and also of the, single view. The single view is a much bigger file, so I typically don't do that one, but we can do them both because they're both available. And I'm actually in the process of redesigning our storage, our file storage system, and moving to a new platform. So this would be kind of an opportunity to create those, you know, protocols for video.
I remember we used to do it, but then we switched over, and I understand the reason if you're having a large group, but it reminds me of a corporate setting for some reason, where we're getting ready to sign a contract and we want us to look at everyone's face at the same time. So it doesn't, for me, engender a sense of rapport with a very subtle kind of language and face interplay and sharing of drawings. It's a much more intimate kind of feel than the other way. So that's my, but we, now I know, because before I had no idea that it made a difference, but I think it does make a difference.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
I agree. I think just like here, we have the option of doing speaker view or collective view. I think if that were available on the YouTube rebroadcast, I think that'd be great. 'Cause sometimes, yeah, I'd like to be able to click on the person speaking and not see everything else. But other times, I like to watch people reacting to the speaker.
Well, the recording, that's possible. Yeah. So the recording would be one or the other. But since we have both files, there's no reason we couldn't save them both and make them both available.
That would be,
one would be on YouTube and one would be on Vimeo or something like that. You can't, there's no other way. I mean, because it just, that's what you get on the recording. So you can't switch back and forth in the midst of it. Like you can,
like we can here.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't do that.
Right. Because it's just a video. It's not, you can't alter it. You know, it's like in set in, not stone, but set in bits.
So I have to use my imagination.
Yeah, that's good for you.
We're going to do more of that today, I hope. I sort of have done this in a very improvisatory kind of way, putting this page together and thinking about what I wanted to think about. And I'm just fascinated by this crow and sparrow and the worlds that they live in and the worlds that we live in. And what are the overlaps and what are the differences? And we've been looking at post-formal education. We've been referring to Donna Haraway, the prominent biologist feminist. And I don't know if you guys saw that. There was a video, a short clip from Hitchcock's film, The Birds. And also there was Wallace Stevens, of his poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And I'm just going to make a few remarks, opening remarks, and I wanted to read a few quotations, and then I wanted to just have an open frame, and because we're, you know, focusing around the idea of agency and what agency could mean to the sparrow, to the crow, to the human, to the ornithologist, to the poet, to the filmmaker, and we could then do a little open frame. And I also wanted to do an exercise that I imagine would take about 20 minutes. So I know that we're on a time frame here that Douglas has to leave after an hour. Is that correct, Douglas? Okay, so I'd like to keep it short and sweet so that Douglas can be included in the exercise. And then that'll give us a good half hour, 40 minutes, whatever we want to do. Maybe we'll even have an hour. So that's the plan, guys. Ready to go? Okay, thank you. Let me start with some quotes. Recently, we did a cafe on existentialism, and I wanted to sort of put that in the mix, existentialism, post-formal, integral, aperspectival, the sense of self, agency. What is all this about? And I believe many of us are feeling the pressure, you know, from our environments to respond in much more complex ways than we've had to. But I think these are quotations, I think, very, very different quotations, different kinds of men and different kinds of affective zones that they traveled in. And this one is, the first one I think represents the existential crisis. William James, a great American psychologist, probably the greatest, one of the great philosophers as well. He was a very depressed man, and he had he was incapacitated by depression on occasion, but he managed to, you know, create enormous, magnificent works of science and psychology, huge impacts. But I'm just quoting him briefly. While in this philosophic pessimism and general depression of spirits about my prospects, I went one evening into a dressing room in the twilight to procure some article that was there, when suddenly there fell upon me without any warning, just as if it came out of the darkness, a horrible fear of my own existence. Simultaneously, there arose in my mind the image of an epileptic patient whom I had seen in the asylum, a black-haired youth with greenish skin, entirely idiotic, who used to sit all day on one of the benches, or rather shelves, against the wall, with his knees drawn up against his chin and the coarse gray undershirt, which was his only garment, drawn over him, enclosing his entire figure. He sat there like a sort of sculptured Egyptian cat or Peruvian mummy, moving nothing but his black eyes and looking absolutely non-human. This image and my fear entered into a species of combination with each other. That shape am I felt potentially. Nothing that I possess can defend me against this fate if the hour for it should strike for me as it struck for him. There was such a horror of him and such a perception of my own merely momentary discrepancy from him that it was as if something hitherto solid within my breast gave way entirely and I became a mass of quivering fear. After this, the universe was changed for me altogether. I woke morning after morning with a horrible dread at the pit of my stomach and with a sense of the insecurity of life that I never knew before and that I have never felt since. It was like a revelation. And although the immediate feelings passed away, the experience has made me sympathetic with the morbid feelings of others ever since. It gradually faded, but for months I was unable to go out into the dark alone. In general, I dreaded to be left alone. I remember wondering how other people could live, how I myself had ever lived, unconscious of that pit of insecurity beneath the surface of life. My mother in particular, a very cheerful person, seemed to me a perfect paradox in her unconsciousness of danger, which you may well believe I was very careful not to disturb by revelations of my own state of mind. And I think he wrote varieties of religious experience, and he wrote large chapters on mysticism and perturbations and how often mystics were very disturbed people. But this is, I think, a healthier look by a British doctor named Richard Morris Buck. He published this account in a book he wrote on mysticism. It's a classic called Cosmic Consciousness, which I've not read, but I've read this quote many times. This is in 1901. So we're talking about William and James and Richard Buck are pretty much contemporaries. He's also, interestingly enough, Richard Buck is presenting his description of his own personal experience in the third person, unlike James, who is writing in the first person. So it's a little odd sounding at first. It was in the early spring at the beginning of his 36th year. He and two friends had spent the evening reading Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Browning, and especially Whitman. They parted at midnight, and he had a long drive in a hansom cab. His mind, deeply under the influence of the ideas, images, and emotions called up by the reading and talk of the evening, was calm and peaceful. He was in a state of quiet, almost passive enjoyment. All at once, without warning of any kind, he found himself wrapped around as if it were by a flame-colored cloud. For an instant, he thought of fire and sudden conflagration in the great city. The next, he knew that the light was within himself. Directly afterwards came upon him a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Into his brain streamed one momentary lightning flash of the Brahmic splendor which has ever since lightened his life. Upon his heart fell one drop of the Brahmic bliss, leaving him thenceforward for always an aftertaste of heaven. Among other things, he did not come to believe. He saw and knew that the cosmos is not dead matter, but a living presence, that the soul of man is immortal, that the universe is so built and ordered that without any peradventure, all things work together for the good of each and all, that the foundation principle of the world is what we call love, and that the happiness of everyone is in the long run absolutely certain. He claims that he learned more within 5 seconds during which the illumination lasted than in previous months or even years of study, and that he learned much that no study could ever have taught. The illumination itself continued not more than a few moments, but its effects proved ineffaceable. It was impossible for him ever to forget what he at that time saw and knew. Neither did he, or could he, ever doubt the truth of what was then presented to his mind. Which to me, that last report resonates a lot with Aurobindo. Almost verbatim, the kind of things that Aurobindo was describing in great detail, I think matches both their descriptions. I believe that the depressive was, I think he transcended it, but I think Aurobindo definitely knew something about the dark side and spends quite a lot amount of time exploring the inconscient, what he calls the inconscient or the ignorant. Anyway, so that's sort of my orientation to this this material. One more, so we're looking at William James, the pessimist, Buck, the very optimistic mystic, and looking at Hitchcock. And if you remember that film, The Birds, I think he really does express a very, the beginning of the postmodern with a very fragmented, disenchanted view of nature, human. But I believe Wallace Stevens is more of that modernist, early modernist. He has certainly a detachment and able to take multiple perspectives, but he's incredibly charmed by this alien other, and I think offers a sort of a wonderful tribute to the trickster-like quality of the blackbird. So those are my feelings. I think that the filmmaker and the poet, I think we can contrast and compare them with the view of the ornithologist, which I believe Douglas is very, Douglas, I think you're going to sing the song of the sparrow for us, are you not? You promised to do that. Okay.
If necessary.
It may be necessary after this. So, okay, guys, I wanted you to see this as the reality of the sparrow and the reality of the crow. Now, if you saw that video, you saw how the crow is using a strategy to crack the nut. And so the sparrow, however, is in the same environment as the crow, so this is what I guess Deleuze would call the plane of immanence. So they both share the plane of immanence, but it's pretty random for the sparrow. But what is random for the sparrow is very ordered by the crow. So the crow can take many different elements and he can compose a sequence. He can abstract 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 steps involved in getting this nut cracked. And as far as we know, when the first crow who did this had done something brand new. The crow had cracked a nut. Something new in the universe was created. I think many nuts have been cracked since then by crows. Maybe it's caught on. Maybe it's a part of their culture. But I think the point is that these are different realities. And who is studying all this is the ornithologist over here. He can view the reality of the crow and he can review the reality of the sparrow and he can contrast and compare these two different realities. And I would speculate, as we did on the Aurobindo call, that the birds and the humans are being, but all of their interactions are happening within the cosmos. So this leads us into the idea that realities are layered, and that knowledge is produced through regularities, rules, conditions, and then patterns and meta patterns. And this is, and both animals and humans are engaged in this. So I'm speculating that we're moving rapidly towards, we're moving out of the postmodern into something. Some are calling it the apperspectival, the integral, the emergent age, the technological age, and the planetary futures that someone like Gidley is trying to track, looking at Steiner and Aurobindo and Wilbur and Gebser and Bergson and Henry and William James also. I think you could include him in this class of writers. So we're doing this kind of open frame, I think we could start on. And I would just sort of hopefully something of interest is here for each of us to develop. And we can all tune in to one another. And hopefully after we do the exercise, we can, we'll have a much more, hopefully a real robust and embodied response to this whole post-formal project. So could we start with, I'm just gonna ask, you know, where do you wanna start? Doug, you want to go first? First of all, could you do that little the solo of the white sparrow? What did you call it? The white-breasted sparrow?
It's the white-throated sparrow. So I guess I'll give a little context as to maybe what you're talking about. I don't know which talk we had, but I think it was just me and you and someone else, maybe Michael. But I relayed an experience of these invisible worlds that I tend to only have when it's myself. But I was going to my local tall hill to do some climbing, to get some exercise. But I had been hiking, kind of jogging and running till I got tired and doing some walking. And then I went down a trail I'd never gone down before. And it was silent. It's a park that there might have been the highway nearby, the rumbling of the like air brakes or something from big tractor trailers, but that was unnoticed. I heard some crows calling, but then I kind of traveled into perhaps a sanctuary for birds where the trail ended. I was kind of exploring there to see if the trail went further, but it didn't. But I came across maybe a collection of birds, and recently I downloaded an app so I could identify birds, and I recognized the bird as the white-throated sparrow, which, let's see, it goes... But there's some variation. I don't know if there's multiple different types of sparrows, but the white-throated sparrow makes this call. And just to mess around with it or to play around, I had already been kind of transported into this zone, a kind of silent reverence, I guess you could say, for nature. So I changed up the ending to not just go, but to kind of go. And the bird responded to me with the identical call. So this is the sparrow that you're talking about here. This is the bird brain sparrow, and it is capable of learning. That was soon after our free will discussion. So I was thinking, maybe birds aren't set in stone. They can learn new language. Then at the same time, I had this transmission of sort. I don't know how to explain it. I might not go too far into it, but I assumed it was coming maybe from the bird. It wasn't teaching me a new song, but perhaps I'm the godlike figure for the bird, and it's, oh, wow, I'm going to speak that language. So, but I received something from some unknown presence that further connected me with nature, so to speak. And it's one of those moments that I remember. I think you posted the Steiner and the spirit language, is that what it's called? Or language of the spirit, or spirit of language. And it goes along with, like right now, I don't know if you four of us here understand the words I'm saying. I might have kind of transmitted the story, but to actually get the feeling of this invisible world, I'd either have to be a great storyteller, or you yourself would have to have the experience. You mentioned the mystical experience, and how I think our interpretation is based on our reception. So if somebody that was focused on just getting a jog in between 2 hours of, or they had an hour gap during a business job or something, this man's running in a suit, he's not going to have time to pay attention to what's around him. He's thinking, I'm getting good exercise in the midst of my work duties or something like that. But it depends on the reception.
It's a white-throated sparrow.
Oh, could I see that again? And while you hold it up, could you sing it again? Could you sing that again, Doug?
Let me wet my whistle here.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, pretty good, huh?
Yeah, I think this is like a bifurcation point in the cosmos, actually. pardon me, that's my, you can ignore that. Thank you, Doug. Is there anything else, Doug? Did you finish what you wanted to say for now?
No, just wanted that last statement I noted, the interpretation being based on reception. Maybe that's something I'm exploring during this conversation.
Yeah, I read that with great interest, the Steiner paper. It seemed very accessible compared to most of the stuff I've read of his. So thank you for that. And Marco, can you go next?
Yeah, with respect to the Steiner paper, it's interesting because it kind of anticipates the later so-called linguistic turn, or not linguistic turn, but turn into language in philosophy. Heidegger wrote some very similar, but much harder to read essays on language and the agency of language, you could say. One thing that he said about language is that language speaks. And I think he saw language as more than a tool that humans use to communicate, actually a presence, and a more than a presence too, because not a simple presence, this sort of revealing and concealing presence that one listens to, and that the poet or the thinker listens to, is receptive to, and then allows to speak. And I think that one of the sort of ways that that phases into this inquiry into invisible worlds is that there is a way one can let the world speak to one, and in its own language, rather than English, for example, or whatever our particular way of using language may be. I, in reflecting on this theme, and in the days leading up to this event, haven't had much time for study. I have a friend visiting, and have had other things preoccupying me. But one of the things I did is I meditated with my dog, Mubi. And Mubi is actually back there right now on my meditation cushion. I don't know if you can see her. She's illicitly on
my meditation. Yeah, I see her.
This is an illicit move on her part. I usually forbid her to sit on my meditation cushion because she's developed a habit of licking obsessively. This is something that's happened in her later age. She will lick any upholstery repetitively and obsessively It seems to be a way of self-soothing, and I don't want my meditation cushion all licked up and, you know, stinking like dog breath. So I don't usually let her sit there. And the other morning, I was in here to meditate, and she was here. And I thought, well, I'll just sit on my meditation cushion just so that she doesn't sit on it. And she has her own little bed here, and it's a fine bed. But I put the bed in front of me to see if she would sit with me, because she often does, or she has in the past, and she would get cozy. But this time she didn't seem to want to, and she kind of felt restless. And I'm sitting, so I'm sensing her movements and the subtle, you know, variations in her breathing or her pacing, or I'm tuning into her, and then I'm thinking about the cafe and imagining, well, this is distracting my meditation because I'm not just feeling my chakras or, you know, my breath or whatever other objects that I might focus on in a meditation session. So let me just see what happens with Mubi. Because I know that she operates on me in psychically. There is a way that she has of looking at me, of staring at me, of getting my attention, of directing my attention, and of playing on my my own fears and desires to get what she wants. And I know that she's doing this, and we're always in these kinds of dynamics. But I wanted to see how long I could sit, and like before, in some way, she acted on me. And she, like I said, was restless and ended up wanting to leave. I didn't know why she wanted to leave. Sometimes she goes out, and then 2 minutes later, she's pawing at the door and scratching and wants to come back in. And it's annoying because whatever I'm doing, she's going to interrupt it. And so she's interrupting me to let her out, and then she'll interrupt me again to let her in. And I decided just to sit and see if I could pacify her in some way, and, you know, bring her to release her anxiety and to settle down and sit with me, because I wouldn't be able to settle down unless she did. And I sat and I sat and I sat, and I don't know how much time went by, but I allowed my mind to settle like I do when I sit, but she didn't settle down. And so it became this almost battle of wills, I felt, where she began, she circled around me, and then she pawed at the door, and she came back, and she circled around me again. And I wanted to see the moment when my own will gave up. And, you know, because it happens very subtly. It happens just with a little twinge, a little muscular contraction. Like you're suddenly up and you're going to the door and you're doing the habitual thing. You're opening it. Or if she wants food, you're feeding her or what have you. There's something that happens subconsciously, but in the meditation experience, one can observe how it happens. And it's very simple. Like there was just a moment where some kind of switch occurred, and my own will gets subverted. And I go through an ideation process where I start imagining, well, what if she urinates on the floor, or what if, you know, some other terrible outcome happens? And then finally that ideation process kind of exhausts itself, and there's a kind of break. I get up, open the door, and I let Mubi out, and that's how the interaction unfolds. And I know that this happens as a pattern again and again and again. And this is part of the way that we regulate and govern each other as as, you know, sentient beings in community. And this is how we communicate. But it's I don't know what to make of it, because I wish that I had been able to just bring her to settle, because I think that she expresses a part of myself that is unsettled. I think that there's not a simple binary between her existence or her psyche and my psyche. like I often find that she's expressing an underlying feeling or anxiety I have, and that the ways that her behavior transforms reflects my own and vice versa. So I'm delighted by, I'm more in the amused camp at this stage and with respect to this relationship. I like birds too. And the last thing I'll share, which I've shared once before, was that I did have a moment when I realized that my mind is not inside of my head. And I remember the moment when it happened, and it wasn't too dramatic. It wasn't like I wasn't on psychedelics or anything. I was just in a bus and I was on the way to school in college. And I was just looking out the window and looking at the trees and things around me. And I realized that my mind is not happening here. It's happening all around. And that's where my intelligence actually was. And I'm not such a nature mystic that I have, you know, all kinds of experiences. But that sense of mind at large, I think, is what these kind of interspecies and these field experiences bring into awareness or liberate in awareness. So I appreciate that in this inquiry, and I'm glad that I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. And I think William James, who is the master of introspection, would be very proud of you. I think you're phenomenologically very attuned to that to your internal process. And I think we're getting a glimpse into how we might start thinking about coordinating mind nature. Because somebody's got to do it, you know. And if it's not going to be us, I don't know who else will. So who wants to go next? Mark, do you want to go next? Or
I don't even know where to start.
Start wherever you want. I'm taking notes.
You're taking notes. I thought Doug initiated this cafe, but did you, John?
It was me and Doug, because Doug and I conferred about the post. You know, the last one that we did on post formal and Gidley, and we had a conversation about this, and we needed to do something fast. It was Friday, right? So if we're going to do this cafe, and I think in a way that makes the best use of our time, someone had to do it. So I just jumped in, and I changed my mind. No, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that, you know. So but I got my inspiration from something that happened in another, when we were working with the Altered Reality Group. We had some conversations around structuring agency. And it's in a world where the physical, the community is physically absent. What kind of agent is that going to be? Because this is the first time that probably ever happened in history that most of our community, we've not even met. So anyway, I think that's what triggered my interest in also working with this nature mind, you know, coming together, hopefully, with the animal kingdom and all of our theories about that. So anyway, that's my spiel on how this particular event has sort of emerged. But where it will go, I have no idea, Mark. So help me out.
I watched, I think it was your last Aurobindo Life Divine, and you also showed that diagram with the bird and that really caught my attention, and I linked a article written by Lauren Isley that Jeffrey had mentioned about Lauren Isley. Yeah, it rang a bell. He's just fabulous. I I would call him more of a anthropologist than a naturalist, but you could do both. So the idea that he put forth in the essay that I linked was that animals and humans seem to think that we're at the top of the evolutionary scale. And he even calls something that long before, in one thing, you guys talked about a ladder. I don't know who was talking about that.
Yeah, the shining ladder.
The shining ladder. That's a very long, it has a long history. Before Darwin and evolution, there was something called the Scala Naturae, it's French or something. It means the chain of being and the ladder of perfection, and that evolution was progressive, and we were at the top of the ladder. We were the highest form, and Eisley is sort of questioning that, looking at behavior of animals. And he was sitting there watching squirrels and try to solve the problem of getting food when somebody put a squirrel barrier. And finally, one squirrel, now he interpreted this can be, you can question all this, but one squirrel watched all the other squirrels try and get around it and fail. And this other squirrel figured out, this is Eisley's thinking anyway, that the squirrel figured out how to get around the squirrel barrier to get the food, much like the crow figuring out how to crack the nut with the watching the lights and everything. So Eisley's supposition or his thought process was, well, maybe we're not at the top. Maybe we're just, we humans are just dominating the biosphere now. And if we were removed, then something else, be it squirrels, birds, or something else, just waiting for an opportunity to nature abhors a vacuum, to take over the biosphere. And he's got all these pictures in this one, or is another article. I got one of let's see if I can show this. This is a finch. Let's see. This is a finch using a cacti prong to stick into a hole to extract insects out of. And Darwin observed this. So here we have two different, well, we have, what do we have now? We have a squirrel, we have a crow, and we have this finch, all seemingly solving problems, thinking how to solve the problem of, I'm hungry, I need something to eat.
Don't forget Mubi.
Yeah, the dog, yeah. We have a dog, a crow, a finch.
Well, and the dog is manipulating you, Marco, much like a child will manipulate their parent if the parent allows it to get what they want.
So there's an agent.
And then you get this interaction. Now, I may be far afield here, I don't know. But a long time ago, I went up at the mountains with a friend and my young little puppy, and we did mushrooms, peyote, actually. And then we got into this thing. I got into this thing with my little puppy, and I wrote a paper on it for one of my anthropology classes. And the professor just loved it. But looking back on it, you can get into an altered state of mind and start communicating with animals and, Lord only knows where it winds up. If you just, it can get, because the animal starts to react to you and you react to the animal and you wind up in this very strange place.
That's what Donna Haraway calls, can we become a companion species where the boundaries are blurred in a creative way rather than this divorce between humans and animals, which is so destructive.
Well, it,
according to her,
all of it sort of revolves around the need for animals, of which we are one, I believe, to feed ourselves. We need energy and we get it from food. And when push comes to shove, the human will eat the creature because we humans have eliminated all the creatures that can eat us. You know, we've got them locked up in zoos and preserves and whatnot. We've eliminated the threat. Marco's been to my place. We can walk out at midnight into the wilderness and don't have to worry about being eaten by a lion, tiger, dinosaur, whatever. There's no problem because we've solved that problem. But if push comes to shove in other cultures, they'll eat the dog. They'll eat the bird. The bird can't eat us. We've eliminated the wolf more or less. There's a few in preserves and stuff, but we don't have to worry about that. So, you know, as far as communicating with them, we can go down that road. You can go down that road if you want to.
Something that you were saying sort of triggered my memory of the Sargasso eel, because I want to be sure marine biology is covered in this as well. So we have birds, we have mammals, and the marine, there's the Sargasso eel. They're in the Sargasso Sea in the middle of the Atlantic. And evidently they're born in two places on the planet. I think it's in somewhere in a lake in Switzerland and the Great Lakes in the United States. And they travel, and the Sargasso eel is 2 inches long. They travel to the Sargasso Sea in the middle of the Atlantic. They mate and I think lay eggs and die, and their offspring go back to those two origins. I got this from Colin Wilson in this book, Super Consciousness. So I'm just putting that in because I want to be sure the marine life is represented in our conversation, because that's a pretty awesome achievement for a 2-inch little creature with virtually no brain to pull off. And so we really don't know. These are very mysterious. But I think what we do, we don't go around, let's kill as many species as we can today. That's not our intention. We're just stupid. We just don't pay attention. We're not keeping track of these patterns, and we're interrupting the life cycles of many different species. And they don't get a second chance. If you interrupt their cycle once, you take away, because of fertilizer, because of plastics or whatever, you know, when they lay their eggs are supposed to hatch when there's going to be enough food. And if you've disrupted that, the eggs hatch and they die. And that's the end of that species. So I think this is what we have to sort of, and I think these are what the naturalists like Isley are pointing out to us, is how this animals are profoundly intelligent and we can't make it without them. So thank you, Mark.
Well, I'm looking for another picture when you talked about marine life, and I'm having trouble finding it, but it shows the at the very inception of creatures, we being all animate life, even sea creatures, are so similar. I'm going to show you this. It's a human, a rabbit, a lizard, a newt, and a dogfish. in the bottom is at the beginning, and it's actually the brain showing two halves of the brain, and they're almost identical. Let's see if I can do this.
Yeah, I see it. I see it. Okay.
And then as the thing develops, then they start to differentiate the dog, fish, the human, the rabbit. But in the beginning, when they first start to emerge in the life cycle, they're all the same. Make of that what you will. But yeah, I'm a evolutionist, a biologist, a naturalist. And so, you know, I love this stuff, but I've been studying it for 50 some years.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Mark.
Sure.
Michael, you want to go for it?
Wow. I'm not sure how to respond to all this.
Start wherever you want.
Well, as usual, I have to start with my own experience without it being inferred that it's the only experience. But my own experience along these lines is more of of listening to the unseen language of my own body and how it relates to the environment and how it connects to a dog, a fish, another human being. That I think that all our creatures and life, even plants, if you listen to Stevie Wonder, he did an album about how plants talk to you. I think I'm a little bit in the far left field and in another planet with Mark, because I think it's just perfectly natural that there is communication going on. It's just we have to learn the skill of how to listen and how to interpret, just like any language, French, whatever. I take language in a very broad way, and then there's specific uses of language. I've had many experiences when I've hitchhiked across country and being out on the side of the road and just hanging out there, and some ants coming up and started just hanging out. Now, I'm not saying they talk to me the way I talk to you, but obviously they were forming a pattern that they wanted something from me. I don't know what, or at least that's the way I take it. I think communication, I think maybe I take it to the spiritual of it. In depth, it's a way of communing with life in the biggest possible way. But at the same time, you don't want to get lost. I agree with Mark. You got to be careful how you're relating to all this stuff. You know, take your time, slow down. But as far as being a human being, I think one of the gifts that we're given is infinite possibilities. And I think we take it for granted. I think we take it for granted by the way we don't maybe challenge what possibilities we're saying, oh, this is possible, this is not. Sometimes you got to go back and go, wait a minute, that possibility I didn't believe, but something's happened to change my outlook. Not maybe in an extreme way, but just enough to say, I need to take a look at this from a different angle. So, you know, per my alternate reality session, I've been a jellyfish, and I've been a human being in extreme pain on many levels, and I wouldn't give up this gift of life for anything.
Thank you, Michael. We're almost at the hour, top of the hour. And Doug, can you stay with us for a while? Or do you have to run? I wanted to do this exercise about 20 minutes, maybe.
That will be fine. I'll be present.
I hope you have some paper and pencil, and if you have some crayons or markers, that would be fun too. I'm wanting to ask a few clean language questions. Most of you are familiar with clean language. I've done it a lot. I don't think I've done it with Mark, though. But I'm going to, I want to develop a resource state that I believe will resonate with a lot that we've covered in this call so far. And that's energy. And when energy, your energy at your best. So I'm going to work with that and ask if, go around, ask a few questions. And then you can make a representation of your experience. I wanted to get, you know, the psyche and the soma and that somatic intelligence engaged with this concept, energy, which, you know, can mean a lot of things to different people. And so without more ado, Doug, shall we start with you?
Sorry, I'm blown away here. Okay, I'm back.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask you, and when your energy is at your best, like what?
This wind is very powerful right now, so sometimes I tend to see myself as an invisible voice, so this is a good reference point. The world's speaking to me now. But yeah, the wind is powerful. So the energy of the wind can be gentle or violent. But at my best, maybe I can harness it, keep it in a jar and let it out when it needs to come out.
And when your energy is at its best, is there anything else about energy when it's at your best?
I'm thinking it needs to be within a routine or within boundaries. Thinking more along the lines of personal energy. So if I'm out of sorts during the day, then I'll be tired before I reach the bed. So.
And within a routine, within a boundary, and personal, and when energy at your best, within a routine, within a boundary, and personal, is there anything else about personal?
I don't know.
And you don't know.
It's, yeah, personal means to come from myself. So at this time, at least, which I know I'm contradicting my own thoughts, but personally, I need to be grounded before my energies will work. Everyone around me influence me at some point, but if I'm out of sync, then it doesn't matter what others think.
And it comes from yourself and grounded. And when you're grounded, it doesn't matter what other people think. And when it comes from yourself, you're grounded. Whereabouts grounded? Is there a size or a shape? When grounded?
Yeah, in various positions, it will come from the roots, I guess. If I'm standing, I'll be in tune with where I'm standing. Seated, as I am now, it'll come from my body, my torso, I suppose.
come from your body and your torso and roots when you're standing or sitting. And when it comes from your torso, whereabouts in your torso?
The chest, the rib cage. It's a deep breath.
And chest, rib cage, deep breath, and then what happens?
Just let it out. The energy can come out at my control with the deep breath.
And just let it out, and the energy can come out in your control. And is that a good place to pause?
Yeah.
And could you make a representation of that in a way that makes sense to you? Thank you. And Marco, can you you want to go next?
Sure.
Okay. And when your energy is at your best, is there anything else or whereabouts? Let me do this again. And when your energy is at your best, that's like what?
It's like the, I don't want to sound too grandiose, but it's like the universe singing.
Ah. The universe singing. And when universe singing, what kind of singing?
Glorious, symphonic, melodic, rhythmic, explosive sometimes, but deeply satisfying, deeply felt and deeply nourishing singing.
And glowing, symphonic, rhythmic, sometimes explosive, deeply satisfying, deeply felt. And when deeply satisfying and felt, whereabouts felt?
All
in universe singing.
Through the body, but centered in heart. There's an opening, there's an openness of heart and a flow and a sort, not that it's a, it's not like a vessel, it's more like a space or a field in which this, more than a field too, because a field is almost flat. So this is a voluminous kind of voluptuous space.
And openness and flow and in the heart and field, more than a field, and luminous. And when luminous, where does luminous come from?
It's difficult to pinpoint in space. It doesn't really have a, I can't say it's there or here or behind me or above me necessarily. Nor is it evenly distributed. It's not like a mathematical sort of abstract diffusion. It's more oceanic, I would say. It's like an oceanic luminosity.
And when an oceanic luminosity, what happens to the body and the heart and open flow?
There's a rest in motion. There's an okayness with the motion. So there's it's part of the rhythmic, you know, if you've ever just surrendered to an ocean, like I haven't done that in the middle of an ocean, but if I go to a beach or if I just allow the current, you feel everything swaying, washing through you. There's a way that, you know, one becomes it. One becomes one. Again, this is where the Steiner piece about language and speech, one becomes one with those flows, those rhythms.
And one becomes one, did you say, with mm-hmm. those flow and those rhythms?
Mm-hmm.
And when rest in motion and rhythmic and surrender and feel swaying and washing through you, what happens to universe?
I wanted to say something about agency. There's something about agency that's involved because, I want to say, I'm not sure if this is true, but I want to say that the universe becomes, doesn't become an agent, it doesn't become agentic, but it reveals its agency, something like that.
Reveals its agency.
Hmm.
And is that a good place to pause?
Yes, yes.
And could you represent that in a way that makes sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. And Mark, do you want to go next? I'm saving you for last, Michael. Is that okay with you? Okay. Yes, sir.
Well, I missed the introduction, but fire away. I have my markers and my pencil and paper.
Okay, I'm just going to ask you a few
sure.
questions about whatever your language is. I'm just going to ask some questions.
English.
In English. Okay. And we're working on energy. Okay. So I'm going to ask you some questions. And so this isn't like a conversation I'm having with you. I'm making my own stuff, keeping it out of the mix so I can just pay attention to your actual language and ask questions about your language, just to let you know where I'm coming from. And when your energy is at your best, it's like what?
It's very active.
Very active. And when very active, whereabouts active?
Well, it can be in conversation, interpersonal, with a individual, or it can be solitary in nature.
Uh-huh.
Preferably the wilderness, but so it's. I'm my energy when it's at its peak is I'm very active.
And when your energy is at its peak and very active in conversation or in solitude, in nature, wilderness preferably, and very active, does that active, when very active, when energy at your best, have a size or a shape?
No.
No. And when no, and very active, what happens next when very active?
Usually a leap, either mentally, if it's interpersonal, or actual physical, say from this particular spot to that particular spot, say if you're hopping, you're boulder hopping, or dancing across a river or something.
And boulder hopping or dancing across a river. And leap, mental, physical, and boulder hopping, and dancing across the river. And when leap and dancing, is there anything else about dancing across that river. Wind very active and energy at your best.
Is that the end of the question?
I think so.
I think it's a risk taking, pushing boundaries. And it's not conscious, it's unconscious. That's just the nature of myself that I've come to understand.
And risk-taking and pushing boundaries. And what happens right before risk?
That's an interesting question. I think that neuroscience, free will, is playing with, you know, what comes first, the mental activity or the physical activity. And you know, is spontaneity impulsivity, is it good, is it bad, where does it originate from? And yeah, when I'm at my, did you use the word at my best?
Yes.
When my energy is at its peak, don't ask me where it comes from.
When your energy is at its peak, then what happens?
Well, I tend to push boundaries.
Push boundaries.
In other words, if you were standing on a rock in a river, and can I make it to the next solid ground? Can I leap this span of river? There's really no way of knowing until you try it.
So standing at a rock, and can I make it? And there's no way of knowing unless you try it.
No.
Is that a good place to pause?
Sure.
And can you represent that in a way that makes sense to you?
Meaning?
You can make a sketch or a model or a draw or whatever. Just a sketch.
Oh, I can. Well, I can look back on my life and just see it, you know, over the decades, that this is something that I do.
So I'm just asking.
Sometimes it works out well, and sometimes it backfires, but I'm still here.
Yes. And I want you to put that on a piece of paper. Just put it down. Present it, like a drawing or a sketch, whatever, in a way that makes sense to you. Okay?
Sure. Sure. I love that.
Okay. Sure. Just like I showed you earlier, this was my idea of a coherent group. Remember I talked about the birds and the V formation?
Yeah, that's my I'm over there.
Yeah. So it's something there. Like this. Something like a diagram, a chart. But
sure,
something
sure, like sure, sure. I got it.
Thank you. Michael. Last but not least, when your energy is at your best, that's like what?
Wiggle, giggle, laughing and feeling inside.
And wiggle, giggle, laughing within.
And let me add, no fear of feeling.
Ah, and no fear of feeling. And wiggle and giggle and laugh within, and no fear of feeling. And when laugh within, whereabouts within?
Well, that's a tricky question, because I'm not sure. The boundaries are very porous, because sometimes it feels like right at the edge of my skin, and yet my skin is like a screen door. It's porous, so that there's a flow. There's a porous boundary taking place. It's porous. So there's a boundary, but it's like a screen door that you keep people out. But and it can be an iron screen door. It's not necessarily a flimsy screen door.
And an iron screen door. And at the edge of your skin, like a screen door, and porous and flows. And does that screen door have a size or a shape?
It varies from time to time of the moment that I'm at my best. I'm not always at my best.
And you're not always at your best. But mm-hmm. when your energy is at your best,
mm-hmm.
and a screen door and porous and flows and varies,
mm-hmm.
is there anything else about flows?
Well, there's a sensitivity to the momentum of flow.
And
when I'm at my best, I'm not reactive to whatever the flow is.
And a sensitivity to the momentum of the flow. And you're not overreactive. And when a sensitivity to the momentum of the flow, whereabouts is that flow?
Well, to locate it, it actually feels like it starts in the feet and goes all the way through my body.
And starts with the feet and goes all the way through your body.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens?
And then I move.
And you move. And what kind of move is that move?
It's a wiggle giggle. What can I tell you?
A wiggle and a giggle. And is that a good place to pause?
Sure.
And would you represent that in a way that makes sense to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we still have you, Doug. I'm glad you're still here because I know you have a schedule that you have to take care of. But can you just show us what you came up with?
Yeah, let me see what I can do here. There we go. Flip.
Oh.
Okay.
It might be a big old mess.
I disregard
the first couple lines. This is my journal, dream journal type thing. I didn't really have any dreams last night, so there's not much to write down. But so I call this the talk amongst the trees. This is the front area is the bottom part of a tree, the trunk, and its base. Quoted Cat Stevens there, at least I think it's his quote. I listen to the wind of my soul. And also titled this The Talk Amongst the Trees. So this is my torso body, I suppose. But as I was drawing, I kind of took the metaphor into many different places and actually became the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So I am the tree, and this is kind of the communication amongst the trees. Then I was imagining, well, the leaves are rustling and changing, and that's actually more the communication there. So, but once I thought about it, I became the wind. This went a lot with maybe what we've been talking about becoming that which is the energy, tapping into the animal, the spirit realm, or the invisible realms, I suppose. So I said, I am the wind. I am not or never winded. I'm also not the wind. I am that, and I am the rock, I think Mark was talking about rock jumping or boulder hopping. So as the wind, there's an invisibility to the wind. It can become that which it is, moving or touching, or its energy is there. It's ever present, but it's not visible. I'm also the bird. I'm blowing the bird. I'm giving it motion up in the sky. Yeah, I had fun with this one. Thanks, John.
And I am the bird, and I am the rock, and I am the wind, and I am blowing. And is there anything else about that I am?
It's not me. Sorry, it's or the eye is not my dug eye. It's an eye, a vision into another essence, another becoming, or another sense.
And is there anything else?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marco, I believe you're next. You're muted, Marco.
That's what I've been drawing. I don't know if you can see it or how well you can see it.
It's good.
Okay, it's basically a doodle. I was trying to give a sense of different kind of currents, energy centers, horizons, lines. It doesn't have a real conceptual content. I mean, you may see some shapes. I mean, the most like a star. I like stars. These five-pointed stars are kind of like human figures too. They recapitulate the form of the human. So I sometimes see them in that way or experience them in that way, at least in this symbolic, this kind of form of them. But I just had, just, you know, because when there is energy, it encompasses many things. So there's a way that there can be a lot going on. Just like if you were to look at the forest floor or in a stream of water, you'll actually see a lot of things that are happening. It's clean and it can move fluidly, but that doesn't mean there's not a lot of complexity and a lot of kind of motion happening within the stream of energy. So I was trying to get a sense of that in this picture. I don't know if I've succeeded or not. I was more or less letting the shapes that are pleasing to me suggest themselves and put them down onto the page. I do have some kind of like radiating like root-like things over here that seems important to have some sort of source that has these branching off points. I don't know if you can see those. More denser, perhaps, as in this in some areas compared to other areas. Some dimensionality too. I just found like that creating a few geometric shapes and a few lines, straight lines, gave a sense that there's also abstraction and mentality as well, and that there is a place for perfect forms.
And a place for perfect forms, an abstraction, a mentality, and dimensionality, and a radiating source, and denser, and five-pointed star, and currents, and energy, and horizons. And what are you most attracted to?
The vision of kind of beautiful coherence, beautiful manifestation, revelation, unfolding. That's a sparkling quality to that experience. There's a sparkling.
Thank you. And Mark, can you show us your representation?
Sure. Let's see.
I can't see it for some reason.
Well, it's a...
There you go. Oh, I see it now. Okay.
Does that work?
Yeah. Can you say something about it?
Well, obviously, or I don't know, obviously, the stick figure is me leaping across a moving body of water from one boulder to another. And it looks like I have a terrified look on my face. And I'm not sure where that came from. It's just, I guess, into the am I going to make it? The unknown. But yeah, it's very simplistic. But yeah, I'm leaping from one boulder to another across a body of moving water.
And you're leaping across the body of moving water. And am I going to make it? And a terrified look on your face.
And, I'd say, yeah.
And what are you most attracted to?
Well, I didn't put that in the picture.
Oh.
From time to time, it would be the unknown. And that can be represented by a person or an idea or...
And unknown, and it could be represented by a person or idea. And you didn't put that in the picture, but you could add that on. Not now, but in the future, in the planetary future, I'm sure.
But
sometimes
it's transitory. Does that make sense? What's sure. on the other side?
Sure. One thing I sometimes do, like someone make a drawing like this, and I'll get a large sheet of paper, and I'll put this drawing in the middle of that big piece of paper. And now ask them to fill in the new boundary. Fill that in. What are the relationships between that unknown area and what they've already got? And it's amazing how when our energy is at our best, what happens next. So thank you. And that's just a possibility you might want to play around with. Michael.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Did you want to say something, Mark?
I'm sorry, Mark, will you finish? Okay.
Oh, okay. So, can you see this?
Yes. Huddle it up a little higher, please. That's it.
Okay. So, very impressionistic elements of different states of solid, liquid, air. There's the sun and the moon. The picture is framed with darkness. There's a red spot down here that is like the core of the earth, but the earth is supported in space and darkness. There's, like Marco, I like stars. I didn't know that they're associated with human beings, but I like stars too. There's an image of a person there that's probably more than likely me, naked. There's no clothes for a reason, because whether you have clothes or not in the universe, you're just naked, period. And you're exposed to all the elements that's happening, the moonshine or the sun. There is a crow in here because I wanted to put an animal up here. as part of it. There's my, what I referred to last time, a stump. That's a family thing my father had, because our last name is Stump, with a growth plant coming out of it, growing out of the stump, that has different colors for petals that exemplify the infinity of energy being expressed through color. There's also, like, I layered it with the earth, the water table, another layer, and then, like, the redness is the lava in the center of the earth, which is not quite solid and not quite liquid, which is an interesting form of energy to work with. Basically, I don't know if you guys can see it, but my eyes are green and I have a smile on my face, and that's what I would represent as giggle wiggle. Wiggle, giggle. And that's when I'm at my best.
And eyes are green, and a crow, and naked, and the red lava, and the moon, and the darkness, the sun and the moon, and darkness. And what are you most drawn to?
All of it.
All of it?
All of it. There is, it's just like, it's almost feels like the Big Bang. It's just bursting.
And the Big Bang. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you all. And I guess my big question, let me work on this. Okay, and the Big Bang and the leap across boulders and the unknown. And the vision of beautiful coherence unfolding. And I am the wind. I am the tree. I am the bird. Is there a relationship between all of that and a sense of agency? So that's a big question I have. And planetary futures. So we have about half an hour, so the floor is open. We can go wherever we want. Thank you. Go for it, Michael.
Well, I think there is a relationship to agency, just in the sense of, where do we put our attention? I mean, we're given, in this life, we're given, it seems to me, a capacity to pay attention, to move our attention as we interact with our surrounds or whatever, and to pay attention even what's happening within ourselves. So I think agency, it does relate to agency in the sense of attention and what attention is doing, where it's going, where it's not going. And sometimes that's more important, is paying attention to where I'm not focusing as much as where I'm focusing.
And paying attention. Who has something different?
Well, I don't really have much to say in the form of an assertion, but I think that agency is really comes out of the interaction between oneself, or what one conventionally, habitually would identify as oneself. How do I use my attention? How do I direct my energy? And the environment, conditions, at every level, the natural environment, the psychic environment, spiritual environment. There's one way that I've been framing that for myself has been with the questions, what do I want to have happen and what wants to happen? Those are two sides of the same coin in a way, but they have, asking them will elicit different responses or effects. How I think asking them both and moving between them both is could be an important practice, let's say. That's part of what I'm practicing with, is holding both of those questions and then seeing what wants to happen in relation to what I want to have happen and vice versa, and discerning that and by discerning, I mean feeling it. Because when I feel that my energy is clear, there's also a clarity objectively in the field, and vice versa. There's a way that things line up. And that coordination is the experience of agency for me. There are some things I can just will. I want to do X, Y, or Z. But the hard stuff doesn't happen that way. Like the hard stuff comes through a sort of complex and elegant coordination of many forces. That's what's most attractive to me.
Someone have something different or something else they want to share?
Are you able to understand me?
Yes.
All right. I'm in the midst of driving like the wind. But I am interested in the human level at this time, and how I suppose, going back to when I was younger, I was able to feel a deeper sense of understanding and connection with those that I couldn't directly communicate through language, such as maybe Hispanic dishwasher friends when I was a dishwasher back in the day, or even the Filipino community that I often frequent. Without the need to feel like we have to communicate with words, there's something else, like that boundary. There's something that's available when there's no need to have to convey your language what you want to say. And there's more eye contact, there's a deeper understanding. So in a way, there's, even within the human worlds, there's invisible worlds that we can communicate to each other, and it doesn't need language. But I'm just thinking about that right now. I don't know how that relates to everything else. But...
Well, here's my drawing. I'm just doing this very spontaneously. Can you see this? It's sort of like the vertical. And here's the wait a minute. No, this is the horizontal, right? This, it would be like the vertical, the up and down, the hierarchical. And this is what's happening next. As you move towards the integral or perspectival or the technological, whatever this new age is going to be. It's not going to be this or this. It's going to be something like this. Below here, I think I had something that looks like a wave moving across a grid. I think that sort of represents for me like the AI intelligence. And I, up above, I did see a flock of birds in a V, in that V formation. And each bird, of course, is trying to find a slot in the V formation. I think they call it something about the least, it looks for the, where there's the least resistance. The bird in front of it, to the left of it, or to the right of it, there's a sweet spot. so that the bird flying at the front, when it gets tired, it can go back, when another one in the behind can go into that lead position. So they can maintain coherence over a long, long flight, thousands of miles, which they could not do as individuals. So I think this is a sort of I'm just trying to put together some of the patterns and the meta patterns that I believe we're working with, late stage capitalism. At the modern era, the postmodern era, with the fragmentation and the disenchantment. And what happens next, as we look at our history from the early cultures to the Axial Age, the archaic, the magical, the mythical, to the scientific age, which dominates us now. And my concern is, I think we've been, I really have enjoyed this forum and other forums that we've had, because I do think we have a kind of history of transformations that we have an archive too. So a big concern I have, and I think this is shared with many of us, is, well, what happens to the body in all of this as the AI starts to change our biology? You know, they've already I can't remember which animal it is. It's a little bitty creature, but they've genetically modified it. So it used to have two eyes. I think, it's a beetle. Now we have three-eyed beetles. Three eyes. This is like something new in the universe.
And goodness.
And it defies all of our logic. And when they let it out in the wild, who knows what's going to happen? So what I think this is what that means. We have all these systems. We're moving from a systems theory, kind of cybernetics, an observer observing a system over there, to something that's much more complex, multiple systems interacting in ways that may not even be computable, because all these algorithms are not coordinated with other algorithms. And these artificial intelligences, of course, are artificial. They have no body. There's nothing felt. There's nothing there's no perceptual space from which they operate. So we can all imagine this could be very liberating if we use this technology to, eliminate cashiers so they can go off and do something more useful with their lives. And we could also eliminate the CEOs, because there won't be a function for a CEO. There won't be one person at the top of the pyramid who's going to be calling all the shots or has to make all the predictions. The computers will be doing that. So what are we going to do? I think that's a very big question and a very interesting one. And how are we going to motivate ourselves? Right now, so far if you think about a quality, something like justice or love or compassion, these are concepts, but each of us has a visceral experience of somatically, just as you've demonstrated. We've just talked about energy, but each of us have had very different ways of mapping that based upon our somatic intelligence and our use of language. So I think we need to keep our body somewhere in the picture, because how can you have compassion without a body, or a sense of justice without a body? So I think these are the kind of questions that keep me up all night. And and how do we handle this intensity? Because I think we're all feeling it, because we're all making this transition together into this, what's going to happen next. And how can we bring our attention? What is it you said, bringing our attention to paying attention to our attention? I think this is the big challenge. And I think the reward for doing this kind of work is we start to become better map makers, because all of these are just maps, but I think we get them into our neurology into our perceptual space, then our concepts become more creative, and the conceptual space gets more lively. So that's my big spiel. So we have about 15 minutes. We can go wherever we want to with this. I hope someone else has something. Yeah, go, Michael.
Well, I think what's interesting that's being played out is that our concepts are energetic. Literally, they're a subtle form of energy that we've somehow worked into a frame of how to work with the body's energy. Right. That the energy is on different levels of compaction, you know, from the solid to the liquid to the fine, you know, and I that's one thing out of my trauma. I realized that I had to really, I worked with this edge of how my thoughts and my concepts affected how I experienced the inside of my body from my trauma. And with meditation, and I had some psychotherapy, I realized I could influence it either way. I could change how I conceptualize my experience, or I could move my body to help me change my conceptual experience. If I could just play, that's where I say wiggle giggle, because I learned to, somebody taught me, play with your energy. Stop being a victim of it. Whether it's a result of trauma, of taking a tractor over the side of the hill, or trying to commit suicide, you fucked up. So now what do? Well, fortunately, with the support of people I have, you have an opportunity to bring a newness to how you relate to the energy that moves through your body from a somatic level, emotional level, mental level. It really became important to understand how to ground my body so that I could work with the mental energy that it was my fucked up mental energy that drove me to attempt suicide. So I had to actually work with give the attention to the intensity that I actually had frozen in my body from my history of life, from my certain things that happened to me. That there were certain, I had to turn towards the intensity of energy that was stored per se, really in my body. And especially after my attempted suicide, it became important. But when I had the tractor accident, it's like it took it to another deeper level. So it was, I fortunately just feel grateful that I had people around me that did a good job, like you and this group, of modeling for me what was possible out of a situation that I was thrown in, that I didn't know which way was up and which way was down.
And restructuring a sense of agency.
Yeah, and that came, and that restructuring is, to me, I mean, I'm probably fumbling. Restructuring, it broke down my habituated way of where I put my attention. It broke it down, so I started paying attention in a broader way, and not such a conditioned way. I didn't understand. I had been taught to pay attention to this. And, oh, don't pay attention to that. You don't want to go there. You know, I was conditioned not. And so the agency got restructured in the sense it became more of my own, in a sense.
And I just want to, I'm resonating with this, Michael, because I've had the privilege of working with you for several sessions. In our other group, Alternate Dreaming, and working with social dreaming, and working with our different metaphorical landscapes, and how these landscapes can become very immersive. We can get really immersed. And also they become communications or communiques from the field of all possibility.
Yes, yes.
And so I believe that this enhances my sense of agency when I'm in a community, even if it's a physically absent community, where we're paying it, using the quality of our attention in this way, as we're doing, and getting more flexible and more resilient and more coherent, rather than breaking down into the gibberish of, you know, the most of our discourse is in such fragmented and such disarray. It's like the Tower of Babel. I am, though, on occasion quite confident that if we pay attention with this kind of quality, and we're kind of a tribe, you know, we're going back to the tribal in a way, but it's on in cyberspace. And this is something new, I think, in the universe, that we've been able to have benefit from this quality of attention and the narratives and the stories and the metaphors that we're sharing, and you know, creating, you know, a new kinds of subjectivity, new kinds of agency, and new kinds of metaphysics are going to emerge, and someone's going to have to do this, you know. We can't passively just kick the can down the road and say, I hope someone else works on this because I got better things to do. This is front and center, I think, because I don't think we have that much. We have a brief window of opportunity. And we are very privileged because we're laying down the foundations for this new emerging age, whatever it's going to be. So that's kind of a rare kind of occasion.
Yes,
I'm just sharing that, guys, with you. And something, Marco, you mentioned, I can't remember what it was, but I think a question I have is, I think sometimes we conflate integration with meta perspectives, and I believe I've been guilty of that as a postmodern, going through the postmodern, you know, upheavals I have in all kinds of projects and organizations I worked with. This was a tremendous, lot of trouble we had surfing it. So I'm wondering about that. And I think an integral theory that many of us are familiar with, you know, I think we're now in a position, having said to Gidley's paper and looked at Aurobindo and Wilbur, there are other theorists we could look at. We've looked at Sloterdijk. And I think that, I don't know what's going to happen next, but I feel like I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot from all of you, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity. And let's keep it going, you know. Let's just keep modeling. That's my theory. It's like, keep modeling, keep mapping. Don't stop, and don't look back too much, you know. I think that William James and, you know, all these geniuses, we can take them. And Aurobindo, you know, they're brilliant, but, you know, they were up against something else. We're up against something else than they were. So we shouldn't try to replicate them in any way, but we can certainly take inspiration from what they accomplished and build on that. Hmm. So I hope we can share this with all sentient beings. The merit of this work. God bless us all.
I don't have too much to add, but the picture of the flock, that resonates with me, because these talks, at one time I felt like I was at the front of the flock, you know, and kind of a scattering of birds, a few birds behind. I like being able to rotate. I like being able to move back, kind of hang out in the back for a little while, and then fly off and look at that cloud over there, or what have you, and come back. I think that the journey is important. I think it's important that we're undertaking this journey, and that, you know, we're migrating, essentially. Like, we're spiritually migrating from one world to another. And so we don't want to lose course. We don't want to like fall into the ocean or lose course or get kind of scattered. You know, that there's a certain, there's a certain ethereality to this, in the sense that it's, precarity. In any small group, in any tribal group, they're exposed to the much larger forces. And, you know, any individual is exposed to all those forces. And we're not as simple as a flock of birds. We're much, even more complex than, and we include flocks of birds in our souls. But we do have to ask different kinds of questions. And I think that that's what we're doing. And I think that the questions open up new possibilities, and they open up new ways of feeling and relating and moving. So I like the direction that we're going in. It feels like we're, in general, from moment to moment, it could be different, and from day to day, it could be different depending on the wind, which way the wind is blowing or the weather. On the whole, it seems to me like we're gaining some altitude, and we're gaining some, I don't know, distance. I don't feel as close to the mental rational dystopia as I once did.
Yeah, I'm not depressed anymore. I'm not depressed at all. You know, I think this is like a drug. It's better than drug. Using language in a creative way, as we've done today, I think tends to generate very positive mind-body connections.
Well, that's Steiner when he talks about the spirit of language, speak spirit. One of the things I got from that resonates with me, and I know that I've had from an early childhood, when I was 3 years old, I've always had an intense passion to speak, even though I couldn't technically talk until I was about 4 or 5. But I tried, you know, but nobody understood me except my little sister, which, you know, but I feel there is a spirit to our words and how we use them. And this platform has given me permission to work with people in a cyberspace, but I have your faces, I have your voices, and yeah, we're not in the same physical presence, but it's been such a joy to work with such diverse people that are somewhat, oh yeah, I'm interested in this too. It's nice to find a tribe, because here in Riverside, you know, it's hit and miss if I find somebody that wants to engage in the love of language and how to express it.
This may be something new.
It is something new to me.
We're spread out all over the world, you know, but we've created this communication.
Yeah,
exactly. At a deeper level than I would get if I went to happy hour right now.
Or the gym.
Yeah, and so being physically present with other people who are totally distracted is not a particular bonus. So I think the time we spent here is high quality, and we're paying attention to each other, and we're making the most of it. And I believe these are the baby steps that you need to make before you can run and before you can dance. And I think we're working out this technology. I believe everyone has different skill set, and we're doing the best we can to share. But I think I would love for us to think about Steiner and think about Bergson, if we want to add to that list. And then I think we'll really be, moving towards supermind.
Excellent, John. Thank you for your lead on this.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Thank you all. And I'm going to see two of you guys tomorrow for our group tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Doug, we're changing the time to 1:30, correct? Yeah.
Oh, so, 1:30. So that would be 10:30 my time, I think.
Yeah. And when we're ready, we'll make a report from our progress that we're making in that that group, because I hope to use this forum here for, you know, other groups doing projects and working together, and we can come together and sort of do a global broadcast here. Because I believe that the kind of this occasion, this event has emerged out of what we've been doing, working with clean language and, you know, alternate ways of knowing. And I think that we're getting a little more, the more skillful each of us becomes at communicating these very unusual states of body and mind, I believe the better. Because I think it's one thing to have the experience, but if you've missed the meaning, so what? You know, and I think this is something, I'm misquoting Eliot here, but we want the meaning, we want the experience, and we want the meaning of our experience. Anyway, it has to be collectively, it has, our collective intelligence goes nowhere if someone isn't going to take that risk and take that leap into, well, this is really weird, this is I don't know what this means, but I'm going to share it with a group so that something can rebalance. Because I think most of our malaise and our depression and our alienation comes from, we're just not sharing this weird stuff because we don't have a space that is a safe enough container to hold it. So we medicalize it, or we narcoticize it, or we run around and shop all day or whatever. So more power to us.
Yeah.
I agree.
Look on terror on your face is okay if you're jumping over the abyss. It's okay to look, to have a look of terror on your face.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It is. I agree, Marco. It is.
It could be a look of excitement also.
Yeah, it's both.
A little of both, I would
think. Yeah.
And we're all still here, so must be doing something right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye bye.
Take care, buddies.
See you next time.